Welcome to the Lynn Rivers Show. I'm Lynn Rivers. In February, Indiana became the 23rd right-to-work state. In right-to-work states, employees cannot be forced to join a union or pay union dues when working in jobs that are covered by a collective bargaining agreement. In so-called union states, workers there cannot be forced to join a union either, but they do have to pay a monthly fee to cover the costs of bargaining they benefit from. Today, we'll talk with advocates from both sides of this debate. Do right-to-work states enjoy lower unemployment and greater job production? Or does this kind of legislation just weaken workers and widen the gap between the haves and the have-nots? Later on in the show, we'll hear from union activist Samantha Montgomery, but my first guest today is Paul Kersey, who is the labor policy director for the Michigan-based Mackinac Center. Mr. Kersey became director of labor policy at the Mackinac Center for Public Policy in September of 2007, having served as the center's senior labor policy analyst since December 2006. As director, Kersey leads the center's labor policy initiative and researches labor and employment issues. He served on the staff of the U.S. House of Representatives Government Reform and Oversight Committee and spent 3 years at the National Right to Work Committee as director of state legislation. Paul Kersey, welcome to the Lynn Rivers Show.
Well, thank you for having me on.
As we begin this discussion, full disclosure, I belong to the Michigan Federation of Teachers as well as the Michigan Education Association. I was also married to a UAW for 24 years. Okay, Paul, I want to go to you for a definition. Who or what is the Mackinac Center?
Well, the Mackinac Center is an independent public policy research organization, a think tank, if you will. Based up in Midland, Michigan, and we approach things from a classical liberal, free market-oriented frame of mind. We believe that understanding and working with markets is the best way for the state of Michigan to grow and to advance, and that government should provide some certain key services, police, fire, certain bits of infrastructure, public education, but generally the government should have a fairly limited role in society, and that individuals and the various organizations they put together, corporations, families, churches, what have you, really should take more of a leadership role in terms of addressing the problems that the society has.
So the center's position on right-to-work legislation is...
We believe that right to work would be a smart move for the state of Michigan to make.
Why do you think that?
Well, because the economic track record of right to work states over the long haul has been very positive. We see faster economic growth in those right to work states. We see faster employment growth over the last 10 years or so, especially from 2002 to 2008. Right-to-work states added 3% to their payrolls, and that's in spite of the recession that came there at the end. Non-right-to-work states saw their payrolls decrease by 3%. So jobs are definitely growing faster, and Lord knows the state could use improved employment. The other reason I would say is because it really gets back to individual choice and freedom of association. It is wrong, we would argue, to force an individual to pay dues to an organization that he or she does not support, and that may or may not be actually working in their best interests.
So I have to ask about that, though. So you think that a union that is bargaining for safe working conditions, for pay and benefits, would somehow be in opposition to the best interests of the worker?
I doubt that it happens intentionally very often, but you can't assume that the union is going to actually succeed, or that the union actually has an accurate understanding of where workers' best interests lie.
Well, give me an example of where that would be the case.
Well, consider a young worker, a young worker who's just starting out at a company. Now, the typical union contract has a lot of things that are settled by seniority. You have a salary schedule that typically provides larger pay for as you gain experience, Now, whether that experience actually translates into better productivity or anything else like that is a whole other question. But there's usually a step process for gaining wages. As a young worker, even if your performance is extremely good, you're going to be at the bottom end of that step ladder. Promotions, plum assignments tend to go to workers with more seniority. And if there's layoffs, God forbid, layoffs happen, usually it's the last person to get hired is the first person to be moved out the door.
Let me put forward two things about this. First thing is since statistically salaries in right-to-work states are in fact lower than unionized states or union states, wouldn't it be a wash for a young worker? You say, well, if they have the union, they might get less than the people at a higher seniority. But if they're going to get less in a non-union state, doesn't that become a wash?
No, because first of all, wages tend to grow faster in right-to-work states, too. In fact, there are a number of right-to-work states where high per capita disposable incomes are higher than Michigan right now.
Right, but those Virginia, tend to be... Let me ask, those tend to be in states where you have a real disparity between people at the top and people at the bottom, correct?
I wouldn't concede that. I haven't seen the numbers on that particular, but I don't believe that's the case. You're talking about states like Virginia, Florida, Texas, Iowa.
Right, where the people at the top, where lower-income workers are really lower-income workers.
I haven't seen those numbers.
Because certainly I saw, and I'm just going to be provocative here for a minute, when I did my research, I saw that the poverty rates in right-to-work states are higher, which suggests you have more workers working for less money in those states than you would have in the so-called union states.
Well, poverty rates are kind of deceptive thing. They're based on a flat rate of what of income that applies to all states, well, all the lower 48 states anyway, without any regard to local conditions and in particular local cost of living. A $20,000 a year salary will go a lot further in rural Ohio than it will even in downtown Cleveland. So
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, the point is, and this is the other thing about wages in general and cost and in right to work states. Cost of living tends to be lower in right to work states. Meaning that your dollar goes further, and a number of studies have looked at cost of living in right to work states and concluded that wages and salaries are a wash, or that even that right to work states you come out ahead in terms of purchasing power.
Listeners, this is the Lynn Rivers Show, and I'm talking today with Paul Kersey, who is the Labor Policy Director for the Michigan-based Mackinac Center, and we are talking about right to work legislation. You're listening to 89.1 WEMU. Well, let me go back, Paul, to this issue of how we determine benefits or costs relative to right to work, because you know I looked at a number of studies, and one of them, for example, that used Bureau of Labor Statistics in a way that counted jobs, including things like taking care of children at home, 16-year-olds who mowed the lawn at home, essentially anything that had an economic impact was viewed as employment. And so you get a very strange kind of way to determine this. So it's very slippery. You say that, well, cost of living is less in Arkansas than it is in Michigan. Wages in general are much lower in Arkansas than in Michigan. If you take Texas and Alaska, one a right-to-work state, the other one a union state, cost of living, you don't see a lot of differences in terms of employment. You don't see a lot of differences between these two, certainly not the benefits that people argue for right-to-work.
Well, first of all, the example is kind of a peculiar one because Alaska is actually one of the few states that where the poverty rate is set higher by the federal government, and that is because high cost of living is especially high in Alaska. And that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the unions. That's just a matter of they are so far away from the mainland and so distant from a lot of the distribution networks that just getting anything up there is often expensive. I mean, you have television shows about the people who fly cargo around Alaska, and it's just a huge physical challenge. So
one way or the other,
Alaska is just not a really good choice.
We'll use Michigan and Arkansas. Now, you know, because wages are low in Arkansas, and even if they're growing quickly, that could still very much and seems to mean that they're still lagging far behind union states.
Well, here's the dirty little secret about right to work and the wages. Right to work states tended to be poor before they passed right to work.
Right.
So you have sort of a legacy that is in place that predates even the Great Depression in a lot of cases and predates certainly the Taft-Hartley law that created the opening for right to work states. So again, wages tend to be growing faster in right to work states, and that implies that there is at the very least opportunities for advancement in right to work states that you don't have in non right to work states.
Right, but if you're talking about moving from a $9 an hour job to an $11 an hour job, that's a big jump percentage-wise, but that still puts people at a tremendous disadvantage disadvantage relative to union states. I mean, I don't know how you can compare an average of, say, $13 an hour to an average of $20 an hour. Go ahead.
Well, I guess what I would say is this. I think that the main fear that people have is that if right to work is passed in Michigan, yeah, you'll have more jobs, but they'll be lower paying jobs. That's the fear that people have. But the experience of Oklahoma when they passed their right to work bill is that wages were increasing at basically the same rate before and after they passed the right to work law. There is no inflection point. There's not any hint of turning in terms of what wages were doing in Oklahoma before and after.
So why make
the
change?
Wages were increasing beforehand, they will be increasing afterward, and you will not see any substantial pay cuts, at least certainly not anything across the board.
So why make the change?
Because you will see increased availability of employment, and Michigan right now could still really use a boost in terms of creating jobs.
Well, will right to work bring back auto jobs here?
Possibly. I can't talk specifically about specific sectors. But there are a wide range of jobs where right to work is associated with improved employment pretty much across the board. Manufacturing, service sector jobs, private sector jobs in particular, right to work is an advantage. So it certainly wouldn't hurt if what you're concerned about is the auto industry. It certainly wouldn't hurt.
Well, I looked at a study done by the Cato Institute where they argued that if right to work had been in place in Michigan, there would be 950,000 more auto jobs, which means we'd have 950,000 more auto workers out of work because the industry is in trouble. In other words, having more workers, I know there's sort of this supply side argument, but having more workers doesn't mean that we have less unemployment or we have of more income. I mean, I think that the numbers can be really manipulated there.
Right to work, as I said, is associated with better rates of job creation. Again, from 2002 to 2010, the typical right-to-work state added about 3% to payrolls. That's not employment or the number of employees or the number of people in the workforce. That's employment jobs. Non-right-to-work states like Michigan saw employment drop by 3% during the same period, and Michigan had a particularly rough go of it.
Right, because of the auto industry.
Yeah, yeah. And that was a huge part of it, yes. But Michigan had a particularly rough go of it. I think we would be much better off joining the right-to-work states and getting employment to advance at them. I think the main advantage is that employers understand that when they build a plant in Michigan, and they know that that unions are going to be out there, and that there are unions that will at least consider stepping in and trying to organize their workers. When you have a right-to-work law in place, you know that individual workers can give or withhold their support, and most workers actually do join in right-to-work states. In excess of 75% of workers will join voluntarily, but they know that the union can have dues withdrawn from them if they're not really representing what workers want, and that changes the incentives for unions. It means that they have to pay a lot closer attention to what the rank and file actually wants done.
Well, when you say that the union doesn't do things that benefit the worker, certainly there are a number of workers who want essentially the benefit of more money in their paycheck. So you have people who are in the very advantageous position of benefiting from the bargaining that goes on behalf of the unionized members without having to put any cost into it. In other words, they can simply keep their own money and then essentially freeload on the benefits of union bargaining that's being paid for by other people.
Well, I mean, everybody wants better wages and better working conditions and better benefits. That's pretty much beyond dispute. Like I said, most workers actually do join the union voluntarily because most workers can be trusted to make these decisions. We think that workers can be trusted to evaluate what the situation is and decide whether the union really is delivering for them. And most workers will do just that if they see that the union is working
for
them.
There's this truism where we say when it's everyone's job, it's nobody's job. I mean, it seems to me that if you have 25% of workers not participating, not contributing, and 75% of the workers are paying for 100% of the bargaining, there just seems to be something inequitable about that, especially since 100% of the workers get the benefit of that bargaining.
Again, I would talk about the young worker coming in who is put at a disadvantage because of the specific terms of the union contract. You can say that every worker benefits from the union contract, and there probably are some people who do get some concrete benefits who do not pay in. But I don't think we can assume from our safe distance here that every worker benefits. And again, you have to let workers make these choices. They're the best. They're the people who are on the shop floor. They're the people who are affected by this. They know better than we do whether the union really is working out for them or not.
Now, unions have played a really important role historically in the development of safe workplaces, reasonable wage and hour issues, retirement benefits, etc. And it seems like now, once those protections have become sort of part of our societal outlook on jobs, we're saying, well, we don't need them anymore. It's sort of like saying, I'm going to throw aside my 55-year-old wife for my 25-year-old secretary. I mean, don't we need to recognize the role that unions have played historically? Look at the history of what the workplace was like before unions existed, and then extrapolate that may be where the workplace would be going in the absence of unions?
The workplace is not a marriage. We are all free to pursue other opportunities, and there's no moral obligation to, if you have a marriage that's not working out well, there's still an obligation that you shouldn't walk away from it. At least that's kind of widely understood. a job is not like a marriage. You, if you're not happy with a job and you see a better opportunity, there is no and never really has been any moral obligation to remain with it.
Well, what I meant here, you know, is that, you know, it used to be people said, oh, because of unions, American workers are non-productive. And we now know that that's not true, that American workers are very productive in a global comparison. What I'm trying to say is that we have a system that has delivered for the American economy over time. It has addressed very serious problems in the workforce, and now it's being characterized as being a bad thing for America. And I'm not just saying through right-to-work states, but through the general drumbeat against unions across the country. And that's where I see sort of the problem. When we demonize unions, we really ignore the fact that they have brought us to where we are now in terms of workplace protection, pay and benefits. And when I hear people who promote right-to-work, they say, oh, well, the employer would still give health care, or the employer would certainly pay a competitive wage. But that wasn't the case before there were unions.
Well, a free society is always evolving. And technologies and even institutions sometimes have served their purpose, and they take a lead for a while, they serve their purpose, and then something better is found, and old institutions sometimes have to reinvent themselves or sort of take less of a prominent role. It used to be the case that the rotary telephone, the analog telephone system, the old bell system,
right,
was a wonderful system, and it did us a lot of good, and it did a lot to unify a country, to help people stay in touch with their friends and relatives and loved ones across the country. And then over time, something new came along, and we developed first cell phones, and then the internet, or maybe it was the internet, then the cell phones, whichever it was, and the old bell system had to sort of step into the background,
and that's
acceptable.
Right. Yeah, I understand that, but let's take a constant, one that's a historical issue as well as a current issue, mm-hmm. and that's workplace safety. Mm-hmm. And statistically, workforce injuries are much higher in right-to-work states than in the union states. I mean, that was a problem at the turn of the century, the 20th century. It has been a problem all along, and it is a much greater problem in right-to-work states.
I wouldn't characterize it that way. The workplace injury situation, yeah, you can find that there is some discrepancy, and workplace injuries are a bit higher in right-to-work states than in non-right-to-work states. But again, the difference is actually fairly modest. And again, going back to the example of Oklahoma, there's been no shift in workplace injuries, no dramatic shift or certainly not a huge positive shift in workplace injuries in Oklahoma since they passed a right-to-work law.
Right, but there have been in the other right-to-work states.
I'm not familiar enough to say either way on what those numbers are. I'd have to go back and take a look at them. But again, I'm not aware of any research that shows that there's any significant increase in workplace injuries after a right-to-work law is passed.
Okay.
Because the union is, the unions are out there, they are accountable to workers, and obviously workers are going to be paying attention to workplace
right.
injuries.
But the worker who doesn't want to pay a carrying charge to the union gets the benefit of those safe machines and those safety procedures in the same way that the worker who pays his or her freight does.
Again, you're assuming that the union actually does provide a benefit in your particular workplace, which we can't assume from here. And you're also forgetting that you're talking about a pretty, a sizable but a definite minority of workers.
Okay, let's pivot here. I want to talk about the unionized public employees, because that's been a big issue here in Michigan. It's a big issue in Wisconsin, Ohio. And I know that the center has been very aggressive in calling for changes there, particularly for ratcheting back or eliminating union activities and bargaining power for public employees. What's that all about?
Well, I think you struck the nail on the head when you just used the word power. The question is, who is going to finally make the decisions on how public agencies are run and how tax rates are set and how budgets will be set by local governments?
Well, but wait a minute. Hold on. Wait a second. Who will decide and then local governments don't seem to go together in terms of recent legislative action in Lansing. As a matter of fact, there seems to be a very aggressive attempt to remove lots of these decisions from local government entities. We now have state rules about how much health insurance can cost, what local governments can agree to. We have rules about who can get health insurance benefits. We have rules about bidding out certain kinds of jobs and services. Those are not coming from local governments. Those are coming from the state of Michigan.
Well, there's a couple of things about the legislation that's been coming out of Lansing. First of all, most of it is about containing the costs that are associated with collective bargaining. There is what is called the 80-20 rule that sets limits on the benefits that employees can receive. There actually is a local opt-out, and numerous communities have actually taken advantage of that.
Opt-out how? They can pay more than the legislated amount,
yes,
for health insurance?
Yes. It requires a separate vote of the county commission or school board or city council, but there actually is an opt-out provision for this. The emergency financial manager rules, the emergency managers were there long before this particular governor or this particular legislature in place. And in fact, if you were to repeal the emergency manager changes, you wouldn't actually restore any meaningful power to local elected officials. All you'd be doing is reducing the options that an emergency manager has if one is put in place.
Mm-hmm. Now, Governor Snyder said he wouldn't push for right-to-work legislation, but he would certainly sign it. I mean, what's the distinction there?
Well, I think the question is whether the sort of the force of the office is going to be out there, whether he's going to be out there publicly pressing for this thing.
Or his lieutenant governor is going to be.
Or his lieutenant governor or anybody else in his administration is going to be actively pursuing this. The governor has a lot of ability to sort of set the agenda in Lansing, and Snyder has indicated that he's not opposed to it in principle, but it's not a high item on his agenda, and it's not something that he's going to be taking a lead on.
But if he said to the legislature, bring it on, I'll sign it, I mean, doesn't that encourage the legislature to move forward?
If he were to, it certainly would encourage the legislature to move forward, but I don't expect him to take that kind of role.
Okay. No, but he's already done it. He's already said, I will sign it if it comes to me, right?
Yes, but again, let's put it this way. I guess there's a distinction between saying I'll sign it and if it comes to me, and please send it to me. I guess
okay.
That's the...
All right. I want to go over to something that was a controversy a couple of months ago, and that was when the center filed a Freedom of Information Act requests for emails from employees of the professors within the labor policies departments in the three major universities, Michigan State, University of Michigan, and Wayne State University. And the argument was that they wanted to see if people in these public positions, these publicly paid positions, were engaging in politics in the sense of taking a position or communicating a position on what was relative to what was going on in Wisconsin. Can you speak to that?
Well, I think the concern, the basic concern, and I think all Michiganders should understand this, and should appreciate this, is that there was that the academic professionals, the professors, the researchers at the state university were starting to act as partisans in the competition between unions and management and workers.
So that's a partisan issue.
Yeah, it had to be maybe not partisan in the sense of Republicans versus Democrats, but partisans in the sense of unions versus management and in some cases even against workers, we would argue. Let me give you one example. When I was when this was going on, I actually went to a labor summit that Wayne State University's labor studies program put on,
mm-hmm.
and it was basically a labor rally. It was almost entirely a union panel that they had there,
mm-hmm.
and the entire focus of the presentation was, How do we expand unionization? How do unions pick up their power, increase mm-hmm. their power? And a lot of it was about partisan political stuff, legislation that was working through Congress and through the state legislature. At some point, if you're going to have a legitimate labor studies program, what really should be the focus is not just labor unions, but how do we make labor relations work all around?
Well, it also seems like if you're going to be concerned about political activity and taking sides in these kinds of issues, that you would also want to FOIA people in the business schools in each of the universities, or perhaps in the economic department. Because we certainly see people in those positions taking positions, working with groups who have a particular perspective on these. Did the center do that?
That's a fair question to ask. And I guess my response would be to say that the indications that we had sort of going forward into this were that this was more of a problem at the labor relations studies.
Well, did you
programs.
Actually look into it in the business? I mean, do you have data that suggests business professors do this less often than labor studies professors?
I would say that yes, the information that we have indicates that this is a more of a problem with labor studies professors. And a lot of it, I will admit, is anecdotal. But again, there was the labor rally that I saw at Wayne State that was supposed to be an academic forum, and I'm not aware of anything that has come up like that at any of the business schools. If you've heard of something along those lines, we'd be happy to look into it for you.
Okay.
The other thing I would say is that. Business is much more bipartisan in terms of, you know, especially the larger businesses tend to be much more bipartisan. They will support, really, to be perfectly honest, they support whoever they think is going to win next.
Well, certainly not the advocacy groups. They tend to be quite partisan. But we're going to have to stop here today, or we're going to have to stop here, Paul. I appreciate that you were willing to talk to me today. I think you've given people a clear sense of sort of the arguments for right to work.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. That was Paul Kersey, who is the Labor Policy Director for the Michigan-based Mackinac Center. Joining me now is Samantha Montgomery. Ms. Montgomery is the president of GEO Local. GEO, Local 3550 in Ann Arbor, and represents teaching assistants at the University of Michigan. Welcome, Sam.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm glad to have you. Now, we talked in the first half of the show with Paul Kersey from the Mackinac Center, and he has very strong feelings about right to work, and he believes that it would be good for Michigan, good for the country. You are involved in union activity. You have chosen to be a part of the effort to represent workers. Why?
Well, I believe that unions, as we've seen, have helped workers here in the state of Michigan. And here at my own union, the Graduate Employees Organization, we've only helped improve the lives and working conditions of the employees at the University of Michigan for the last 40 years. And that's why I'm involved.
Do you think that union activities benefiting employees also benefits the employer, benefits the University of Michigan?
I do. I think it makes people much more satisfied with their jobs. It attracts more qualified candidates to come to this place of employment. People are excited to work here when they know that they have a voice on the job.
So graduate students are more, you feel graduate students are more likely to choose U of M as opposed to another university because of the fact that they're represented by a union?
Well, I believe that all of the benefits and I believe that all of the benefits that we've been able to negotiate through our collective bargaining agreements over the last 40 years have made this a much more attractive place for employment.
Okay, a much more desirable destination.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when we talk about the right to work states, because we're on that right now, I've got some other things I want to ask you about, but this is kind of fresh in my mind. When you look at right to work states, do you see a difference in the availability of university jobs, in other words, the payments, the benefits for graduate students, other kinds of employees? Do you see the same kind of investment in education, the same sort of pay, benefits, worker protection? From a perspective of university employees, graduate educational assistants, how do they compare, or can you compare them, right-to-work states versus a union state like Michigan?
Well, I'm not an expert in higher education and how it differs from right-to-work states to fair share states, but I do know that in a recent report from the Economic Policy Institute, we know that right-to-work laws have not impacted or boosted the economic growth of employment opportunities. So we know that on average, workers in right-to-work states make less hourly wage, they make less in terms of their annual salary, and we know that it hasn't helped to boost the economy in those states.
So you're saying that there's a loss that is not accompanied by a gain in another area?
Correct.
Okay, so let's talk about this initiative, Protect Our Jobs. I know you're active in it. First, tell us what it's about.
Well, in the past year, we have seen over 80 bills in the pipeline that have sought to undermine workers' rights and dismantle collective bargaining. Here at the University of Michigan, we just experienced the effects of this with House Bill 4246, which prohibits collective bargaining rights for graduate student research assistants who have been trying to join our union for the last 2 years. And that is just one of many scary bills that have come through the pipeline. And Protect Our Jobs is really about ensuring the rights of workers in the state to have collective bargaining agreements and reverse many of what has already passed and protect us for the future.
And protect in which ways? I mean, and what sorts of things would you see being reversed?
Well, because it would amend the Constitution to allow for collective bargaining rights, we wouldn't see some of these bills that have come through that prohibits collective bargaining for certain classifications of employees.
So this would deal with attempts to strip public employees of bargaining rights?
Correct, correct. It would also make sure that we are able in the future to continue to function and have strong collective bargaining agreements that benefits all workers and gives all workers a voice on the job.
Okay, you are listening to The Lynn Rivers Show right here on 89.1 WEMU. My guest today is Samantha Montgomery. She is president of GEO Local 3550 at the University of Michigan. Sam, let's talk about the effort to put the Protect Our Jobs proposal on the ballot. It's an amendment to the state constitution. It needs to go before the people. So what efforts are in the works to make this happen?
Right. Well, we have a petition that we are currently collecting signatures for. So we have many volunteers out there every day here at the University of Michigan campus trying to get signatures so that this constitutional amendment will appear on the ballot in November.
How many signatures do you need?
We are aiming for about 500,000 signatures.
Okay. All right, and there are efforts all over the state?
All over the state. Workers from across the state have come together to recognize that this is something we need to do to protect our jobs and protect the security that comes with collective bargaining agreements.
In Wisconsin, over the last year, we've seen a real back and forth on this issue. And one of the things that was interesting to me is I think that the legislature in Wisconsin and the governor in Wisconsin really believed that there would be great public support for stripping public employees of their bargaining rights. And in fact, I think it was very shocking to them when so many people, not just people in union jobs, but so many everyday Wisconsinites said, oh, we don't want to see this happen. This is wrong. Do you think you're going to see the same sort of support from non-union folks here in Michigan?
I think what happened in Wisconsin, what we saw in Ohio, I think will happen here. I think people want to have better working conditions, and they want to have a hand in helping to create that.
Mm-hmm. Is there any effort to reach out specifically? I mean, one of the things that anti-union efforts, pro-right-to-work efforts have been very good at is this idea that you have sort of greedy public employees that over time they have gotten greater benefits, greater pay, that they've somehow co-opted people in office to give them what they want. Is there going to be an effort to sort of educate people on those facts and then an effort to reach out to people who might have taken a bit different position or are neutral? In other words, is it just going to be an effort to collect signatures, or are you going to aggressively counter the claims that are out there and search out folks who may not be union?
Well, I think that to rebuild our economy, we need everybody to work together to help protect Michigan workers. Mm-hmm. And I think whether people are in unions or not in unions, they recognize the power that comes with collective bargaining. And I think there is an education effort that is out there, but I think most people are wanting to do something about these 80 bills that have come through the pipeline and want a way to respond.
What sorts of efforts are you mounting on the U of M campus, for example?
We have volunteers out every day collecting signatures. We are talking to our members and to other folks on campus about this initiative, and people are excited about it. It's very cool to see everybody get behind this initiative.
One of the things I've noticed with my students is while many of them are liberal in their political outlook, they come from families who are not union families, may be at a higher income level than many workers. And there tends to be a sort of distaste or a almost hostility toward unions. How, as you advance this, as labor in Michigan advances this proposal, how are they going to deal with those sentiments out there? Because it seems like these are people who, with the right information, would probably be receptive to the message. How are you getting that right information out into the hands of people? In other words, is the UAW or the AFL-CIO or the teachers unions, are they mounting any effort to aggressively counter the real hostility that has been heaped upon public union employees over the last couple of years?
Well, I know that as a member on the ground, talking to other folks on the ground, we always have those conversations, right, mm-hmm. about what does it mean in our everyday lives and working conditions to have the protections and the benefits of a collective bargaining agreement. And I'm sure that workers all over the state will be having those conversations with this constitutional mm-hmm. amendment initiative.
Do you think that the situation in Michigan is is comparable to Wisconsin? In other words, is the kind of legislation that is coming out of Lansing, does it look a lot like what the legislation in Wisconsin meant to do or was designed to do?
I believe it does, but instead of happening in one big bill, it has happened slowly and in different series of attacks. So 80 bills in the pipeline for the last year that have targeted different types of employees and different rights that employees have, and it is certainly a very scary time to be a worker in Michigan.
Listeners, this is the Lynn Rivers Show, and you're listening to it on 89.1 WEMU. My guest is Samantha Montgomery. She is president of GEO Local 3550 at University of Michigan. Well, let me ask you, Sam, about a provision that I know has caused a lot of debate at U of M, and that is the state's position that unmarried partners cannot have health insurance. Now, I know the university, I think, has gotten an exception to that, but this is an issue that a lot of institutions have been very concerned about because for many folks, this makes a particular position very attractive because their partner can get health insurance. What has been the reaction, an organized reaction to that particular provision?
Right. Yeah, this was definitely a very scary bill for our members. We have had domestic partner benefits for unmarried domestic partners here now for a little bit of time, and this is something that we had in our contract as a benefit for employees. And when the legislature sought to strip public employees of that benefit, I know not only our members were outraged, but the university administration has also expressed their dismay at this type of legislation.
Well, and I think the university has been very clear that when they recruit professors, oftentimes this becomes a problem. This becomes an issue where there is a partner, a trailing partner, who needs those kinds of services. So it's not just about young people in teaching assistant positions. It appears that this is about lots and lots of folks.
Oh, correct. It's all public employees, right? At not only our university but statewide. And even though my current understanding is that this legislation does not currently affect the University of Michigan, it is still nevertheless fundamentally unfair.
One of the issues that is causing a real pushback, we're seeing it in lots of people, is the Emergency Financial Manager Act, or at least the way it is now being implemented. And there are a lot of people who say at least part of this is about breaking unions. What's your view on that?
Well, this legislation currently allows emergency managers to suspend collective bargaining and local contracts, and we view this as one of the many attacks on workers' rights and attempts to dismantle collective bargaining, and it's not right.
Do you think that there's going to be a legal challenge to this? In other words, do you think that workers are going to be able to turn to the courts successfully for a review of not only the law, but that particular provision, the idea that bargained for benefits can simply be set aside by government fiat?
I think workers have expressed their dislike of this bill, and there have been attempts to overturn this bill with various petition campaigns, and I believe people are going to attempt any avenue to make sure that the right thing is done.
Okay. Sarah Montgomery, I want to thank you for joining me today.
Well, thank you for having me, Lynn.
Great to talk with you. I also want to thank Paul Kersey from the Mackinac Center for being part of today's show. Please join me next week for another edition of the Lynn Rivers Show, when we'll talk about the news, politics, history, or a mixture thereof. Radio that makes you think. The Lynn Rivers Show, right here on 89.1 WEMU.